sports, entertainment, and Maine's best guest list. On The Pulse, AM 620 WZON, WZONThePulse.com, and the WZON app. This is Downtown with Rich Kimball.
Well, hello there. Welcome on into a Sunday morning Best of Downtown. On this 21st day of January, Rich Kimball here with Kerry Haskell. Downtown brought to you by Cross Insurance, where security meets strength. Guests of the program are heard on the G&M Family Market phone line. You can find G&M on the corner of Route 1A and Route 46 in Holden. Open every day of the week from 6 a.m. until 9 p.m. On the program, some terrific recent conversations with some extremely talented folks. Dan Epstein, great music journalist, talking about Bruce Springsteen, a piece he did for Rolling Stone. We talk with Hall of Famer Leslie Visser, who's got a brand new book chronicling her remarkable career as a sports writer and broadcaster. And how about a Rock and Roll Hall of Famer? Our chat with Alice Cooper from Maui, like you do, coming up later on this Sunday morning Best of Downtown program. Brought to you by our friends at Quirk Auto Group, quirkauto.com. It's your car. Find it at Quirk. Let's get things rolling this morning and talk with a legend in the world of sports writing and sports casting. She's a member of the Sports Writers Hall of Fame. She's the only woman in the Pro Football Hall of Fame at Canton, Ohio. And she's got a wonderful new memoir out entitled Sometimes You Have to Cross When It Says Don't Walk. Always a pleasure for us to talk with the great Leslie Visser here on Downtown. The book is absolutely wonderful. I couldn't put it down. I read it in one night. The title, Sometimes You Have to Cross When It Says Don't Walk, A Memoir of Breaking Barriers. And that title comes from something your mom said to you when you were about 11 years old and announced your career plans.
Yeah, thanks for asking. My family moved a lot when I was a kid. My not that people would ever know this, but my father grew up in Amsterdam under the Nazi occupation. He was not Jewish, but they were all starving. I mean, he went to Montessori school with Anne Frank, and, you know, he said, boy, in America, there's so much opportunity, and don't take that for granted. And we were living in Cincinnati, although I'm a native Bostonian, but we were living in Cincinnati. And I said to my mother, I want to be a sports writer, which, you know, that was so bizarre. It was like saying, I want to go to the moon, you know, or I want to be a Supreme Court justice. Thank you, Sandra Day O'Connor. But I said, I want to be a sports writer. And instead of saying, forget it, this is in the early 60s, she said, that's great. Sometimes you have to cross when it says don't walk.
Well, great advice indeed, and you followed that. Now, you mentioned growing up in your early years in Boston. I enjoyed reading about that, and you talked about the three things that everybody loves and talks about in Boston: sports, politics, and AM radio. And I laughed because the other day on our show, we had a guy who was huge in Boston radio back in the day. Dick Summer was on with us.
Of course, of course. I mean, we all... I mean, how do we get to know the Beatles when older than most of your listeners? But gosh, it was AM radio, and you were either BZ or WMEX, and I was a woo-woo Ginsburg kid. But yeah, AM radio is where, you know, you heard the music, and of course, I grew up with the Red Sox. I mean, I couldn't believe I live in Florida now. My husband is from Ohio, but he was actually the captain of Harvard basketball, Bob Knuth, and so, but he retired down here. So it's so strange down here, because what was the one thing the Red Sox needed? Stanton. Stanton is what we needed.
That's
but he
right.
went to the evil empire.
Now, you mentioned your husband, captain of the Harvard basketball team, although you tell in the book that when you met him, you didn't believe it and said, how come I never heard of you?
Oh, I can't believe you told that story. Of course, most people know I was married to the great Dick Stockton, who called Carlton Fisk's home run. That was the night I met him, and Dick was great. Dick and I were married for 26 years, just ran out of gas. But yes, I met Bob Knuth, and when Rick Pitino introduced us at the Kentucky Derby, he said, meet a friend of mine. He was the captain of Harvard basketball. Now I've covered 35 Final Fours, so... You know, I work with James Brown, who was the captain after my husband of Harvard basketball. So So I stuck out my hand and I, you know, you could just see my New England spine going up. And I said, Captain of Harvard basketball, I don't think so. And my now husband looked at me and said, you must have missed 4 years. which is true because, you know, now Harvard gets to the tournament. Of course, my husband, we text Tommy Amaker all the time. But, you know, at the time, you can't say yourself. No one was following Harvard basketball.
Now, I also, a number of things that stood out to me in reading the book. One is apparently our shared affection, although perhaps with different motivation, for former Giants running back Tucker Fredrickson.
Yes, yes. I hope people buy this book because it's about anybody who had a dream, which you're going to have to share with me what your dream was, but mine was just sports. You know, other kids love poetry or love music, but I just love sports. And I finally got around to writing this book, and it's on Amazon and, you know, eventually bookstores. But yes, I loved Tucker Fredrickson. And, you know, in Boston, we don't really follow college football, but, you know, Tucker was, I think he finished second in the Heisman, you know, from Auburn. And, you know, he was just great. And I got to know him because, of course, he went to the New York Giants. So I got to know him later. And now I consider him a friend. But yes, I mean, wasn't Tucker Fredrickson kind of, you thought, because we didn't follow college football in Boston, but if you did, didn't you think Tucker Fredrickson was great?
I did, and up here, before the Patriots really caught on in the early and mid-60s, we grew up in this area, many of us as Giants fans, and so you know, Tucker Fredrickson was the great hope, along with guys like Joe Morrison and Bobby Duhon and, gosh, even Norm Snead.
Yeah, and don't forget Chuck Mercine,
who, of course,
had played at Yale and then played in the Ice Bowl. So, yeah, no, I knew the Giants, too, as a kid. The Patriots were, it's so astonishing to me, and I'm so close to that organization. They've been so great to me. But, you know, when we grew up, they were really bumbling. Remember, they would play in different stadiums. And who was the player? Remember the time they called him out of the stands, that he'd been cut?
That's right.
He was up there drinking in the stands, and they said, report to the locker room, and his friends, who was that? They wondered where he went, and then it was so-and-so on the tackle, right?
Right, yeah, I can't remember. You wrote about him in the book. I can't remember who
it
was.
Yeah, I can't think of him. But they were such, you know, the Patriots, when we all started, they were, you know, if you had pride in the NFL, it was the Giants.
Well, the Patriots, we're talking with Leslie Visser here on Downtown. Patriots are, of course, the model organization these days, and part of that is because of the work of Robert Kraft, who was incredibly helpful to you, but not in his role as owner of the Patriots, but going back to the Lobsters, for people who might have forgotten them.
Yeah, thanks for mentioning that. I think Bud Collins, the great Bud Collins, came up with that idea, lob and tennis, the Lobsters. And he came up with the little cartoon insignia. You know, it was a great team. It had Martina. She had defected. She wasn't yet a citizen, but she had defected. And Robert Kraft decided, wow, I'm going to own this team. They played in Walter Brown Arena. Nobody came. But for me, what a privilege. I mean, I did go on to cover 15 Wimbledons, mostly with Bud, and 25 U.S. Opens. So I know most people identify me with either basketball or football, but I had the privilege. I even went back with Martina. It was interesting. She had come from Prague, as many people know, and she won 5 or 6 straight Wimbledons, and not one word was written because she had defected, and under the old Soviet regime, you were considered a non-person. So not one word had been written, but she went back as a member of the Federation Cup, which was like the Women's Davis Cup, and I got to cover it, and she had not been back to Prague since she defected, and it was really interesting that it was a rainy day. I remember we had to make a connection in Frankfurt on Maliv, which you've probably never taken, Hungarian airline, Maliv Airlines, and it landed in Prague, and of course she took the steps down on the bottom, pouring rain, but thousands of people went there because they heard the great Martina was coming home. And They stood behind chain link fences, you know, really taking on the government, but with kids on their shoulders, you know, just to get a glimpse of Martina Navratilova.
You've had so many remarkable highlights and continue to in your career. One of them that's fascinating to me in your recollection of it in the book is being there for part of the coverage when the Berlin Wall came down.
Really profound for me. As I said, my dad grew up in Amsterdam. Everybody was starving. And so I just had a really small piece of the pie of the coverage. But in November of 89, what had happened, for people who don't know, is that the exit strategy, people were starting to go through Hungary. And East Germany realized, wow, you know, we're losing everything. We're losing scientists and doctors. And my little slice of the pie was athletes, because you remember the great Katarina Witt. She had been from East Germany, and of course all the swimmers won all the gold medals. But there started to be this mass defection through Hungary, and they realized, oh my gosh, we're losing control. So we better, of course, Reagan had been there before to say, Brezhnev, tear down this wall. And to be there was so astonishing. Before it actually broke, we went into East Germany through Checkpoint Charlie, and it was amazing how, like, little things, you know, roll towel, toilet paper, that we take for granted in the Western world, you know, all of a sudden it became the roughest, lousiest paper. And, you know, it was just 100, 200 yards, whatever, the wall as it was built up. But it was really profound to see people. They walk for days, you know, they walk from Potsdam and Dresden just to get through that wall. And, you know, my little, of course it was Walter Cronkite was the main, our main reporter, but I just had a little slice of the pie, but I didn't care because I was there.
You have had so many firsts in your career. You've opened so many doors for women these days, certainly an increased awareness of the struggles that women have faced, really in every kind of work. Is what we're seeing, the Me Too movement and all of this awareness today, is this, do you think, a turning point? Is this a bump in the road? Will it make a difference and finally help make the playing field level for women in all lines of work?
Yes, I do, but I don't know if it's dreamed to. I will say that it's in every industry, and women have just had enough. They've had enough of not being treated equally. I will say that although players, you know, hit on me every day, same thing for Jackie McMullen, same, they were the bubble after me. But, you know, there's no women in my business that hasn't dealt with it. But the people who made my decisions, I owe my career, as always being the first, I owe my career to four men. One, Vince Doria of the Boston Globe, and then three men from CBS, Ted Shaker, now my chairman of CBS, Sean McManus, and the great Les Moonves, who's the CEO of CBS. And not one assignment or one economic decision, I cannot say that for my career, which is 40 years now, none of that was dependent on harassment. So, you know, I'm really hoping. I guess I wrote this book because I think you can have a dream. I mean, and I, maybe your dream was to be, you know, a sportscaster. Mine was a sports writer, but women now can grow up and say, wow, I want to be a sports writer. I want to be a sportscaster. I want to cover the Red Sox, or, you know, I want to cover the World Series. I want to cover the Super Bowl. And they actually don't have to stand down and think, wow, this is going to be a really long haul.
You talk about so many wonderful colleagues you've worked with through the years in the book. Can you share some memories of the great Dick Enberg, who we lost just recently?
Oh, thanks for asking about Dick Enberg. I was privileged to, I first met Dick Enberg when I was at the Globe, and he was doing NBC, the Final Four, with the great Al McGuire. By the way, how about Al McGuire? Because I did get to work with him later. Al McGuire, I remember once at dinner, Al McGuire said, kamikaze pilots, I don't get it. Why did they wear helmets? Isn't that brilliant?
That is great.
So, no, I've worked with brilliance. But yes, Dick Emberg, I think I did 3 or 4 NCAA tournaments with him. And I can remember one that we did. It was Dick Emberg, Bill Walton, and myself. And we had Arizona in the tournament. And Luke Walton, of course, a great coach. But Luke Walton was playing at Arizona. And Bill Walton started ripping him on the air. You know, and you have to picture Bill Walton's voice, right? Walton, that's a terrible pass. What are you doing, Walton? What are you doing? Are you out of your mind? And Dick Emberg had to say, now, Bill. He had to be the father. I'm sure he's doing the best he can. But he was a gentleman, a scholar, a doctorate, and a storyteller.
You've talked with us about Will McDonough and how much he meant to you and so many others, and that incredible Globe staff that you were a part of that several have acknowledged is maybe the best in the history of sports journalism.
Yeah, I think Sports Illustrated did name us. I was the end of the tale, but they acknowledged those years as the best sports section ever. It was Bud Collins on tennis, Peter Gammons on baseball, Bob Ryan on basketball, Will McDonough on football. And it was interesting when CBS first came to me, they came up to the Globe and offered me a job on the NFL Today. You know, obviously Brent Musburger, they were huge. And I said, why would I leave the Globe? And they said, you've got to be kidding. I mean, there are only 20 of these jobs in America. But the Boston Globe taught me a couple things. One, don't take the floor unless you have something to say, unless you're going to report something or you have an anecdote or you're going to introduce something into the conversation. I mean, these people ever to this day, and I'm in my 60s, I've never met more brilliant people, more committed people. It was such a privilege. And I started there at 19 and I couldn't possibly have known how great it was.
By the way, that move into television was fictionalized by the great Dan Jenkins. I didn't know about that until I read it in the book.
Yes, Dan Jenkins. And of course, we love Sally Jenkins was in that bubble that had Jackie McMullen and Christine Brennan. I mean, really, for a little bit there, it was like as good as it gets. But Dan Jenkins, you know, at that time, people didn't go from print to TV. They were very distinct industries, and I don't know that one had that much respect for the other. And so in the book, You Gotta Play Hurt, Dan Jenkins has me fictionalized, and he says, what do you want to spend the rest of your life saying, back to you, Jim Nance? which, of course, is what I've done for 30 years. So it was an honor to know Dan Jenkins, and I'm very good friends with Sally.
I loved it, too. Late in the book, I stumbled upon an excerpt of one of my favorite poems, Halfway Down.
Yes, Winnie the Pooh. Halfway down the stairs is the stairs where I stop. It isn't at the bottom and it isn't at the top. That's one of your favorite poems?
Absolutely. I saw that. I went, wow. No wonder I like Leslie so much. Tucker Fredrickson and A.A. Milne.
Well, you know what? He was a brilliant and a, what was he? Lewis Carroll was the mathematician. But A.A. Milne, I think he was a professor at Oxford or Cambridge, and he just did this to entertain his son. But I do think this. John Madden actually taught me this. You're not going to believe this because this is so unlike John Madden. He said, all you need to know about life is if you read Peanuts every day.
That's not bad advice right there. The book is delightful. It's such a great read. Sometimes you have to cross when it says don't walk, a memoir of breaking barriers. And in the book, you talk about, Leslie, that we all in life have two resumes, our professional resume and our moral resume, the way we lead our lives. And I can say from the interactions we've had through the years, you are all aces in both because you've been so kind and so generous with your time to everybody through the years and continue to be a role model, not just for women, but for men and for anybody who wants to pursue their dream.
Wow, that is so honorable of you to say that. Yeah, I used to I used to think, gosh, I have to represent the Globe. I have to represent the Visser name. Then I had to represent CBS. Then I had to represent all women. But finally, we've come. We've come, Chris Brennan and I and Sally and I and Jackie and I, we laugh about this, that, you know, we used to all be on each other's Christmas card list. And we said, gosh, we really hope there are enough women that, like, I don't know half of them now. And I think that's great.
That's Leslie Visser joining us here on Downtown. When we come back, Dan Epstein, Rolling Stone, talking about Bruce Springsteen on the 45th anniversary of his debut album. It's next on The Best of Downtown.
At Quirk Motor City, you get a huge selection of quality pre-owned vehicles priced to fit any budget. Plus, the Quirk Motor City pre-owned difference, with a limited warranty that's 3 times longer than the average dealer's pre-owned warranty. Free main state inspections for the life of the vehicle. A free Carfax vehicle history report. And Quirk Motor City's certified pre-owned 118-point inspection. It's your quality pre-owned car. Find it at Quirk Motor City in Bangor, Belfast, Augusta, and Portland. View our pre-owned inventory online at quirkauto.com.
It may not be prime biking season, but it's always a good time to make sure your cycle is in great shape. And there's only one place to go to do that. Slipping Gears Cycling, 753 Stillwater Avenue in Bangor. Bangor's only full-time cycling sales and service experts. They offer outstanding service and a huge stock. Make sure you like them on Facebook to get updates, shop in person or online at slippinggears.com.
Since its founding in 1954, Cross Insurance has grown from a small family-owned agency that started in Bangor, Maine, into one of the largest super-regional insurance agencies in New England. With a network of offices throughout New England, Cross Insurance works with top carriers to provide maximum value to you, your family, and your business. We are proud to be the official insurance broker of the New England Patriots and would welcome the chance to provide security for your team. For more information, visit crossinsurance.com. Cross Insurance, where security meets strength.
It's not always whether you win or lose, but who you've got on your team. The Emily Ellis team at Next Home Experience wants you to enjoy the best team chemistry in real estate. If you're looking to buy, sell, rent, or build in the Bangor area, make Emily Ellis's All-Star Squad your go-to team. Responsive and experienced, the Emily Ellis team will make your real estate quest as smooth as possible. Linda, Jen, Callie, and Emily will listen and prepare your game plan. The Emily Ellis team at 57 Washington Street in Bangor, shooting for your goals.
Hi, this is Mike Toole. My company is ClearPoint Financial. We're an independent retirement plan advisory firm located right here in Bangor, Maine. At ClearPoint Financial, we provide guidance-based, comprehensive retirement plan solutions to companies that are concerned about their employees' retirement income security. We focus on plan participants. We help them strive to achieve retirement income security. We provide ongoing engagement, education, investment advice, and service that exceeds expectation. For more details on our financial wellness programs, call me today at 899-2552. ClearPoint Financial, the official financial advisor of the Maine Black Bears.
Penobscot Theater presents...
My name is Albert Sody, and have I got a buck story for you.
Come up to camp for a deer hunting tall tale by actor Jeff Daniels.
Takes place in the Sody Deer Camp, just north of Escanaba, Michigan. That's in the Upper Peninsula, for those of you that don't know nothing.
Escanaba in the Moonlight, February 1st through the 18th at Bangor's Historic Opera House.
There's a couple of things that need to be explained. First is, in the UP, we don't explain things.
Tickets at 942-3333 and PenobscotTheater.org.
On your Best of Downtown Sunday morning, Rich Kimball, Kerry Haskell here on The Pulse, AM 620 WZOM.
Madman, drummers, bombers, and Indians in the summer with a teenage diplomat. In the dumps with the mumps as the adolescent pumps his way into his hat.
45 years ago this month, Bruce Springsteen released his debut album, Greetings from Asbury Park, New Jersey, featuring that, the only song Springsteen wrote that ever went to number one. And it wasn't even his version. It was the Manfred Mann version. Went to the top of the charts. Our friend Dan Epstein wrote a great piece for Rolling Stone celebrating the 45th anniversary of the album and giving you some little-known facts you might not be aware of when it comes to the making of the album. Here's Dan Epstein on The Best of Downtown.
It's a record that I've loved since I first discovered it, which was probably around 1980 or so, like coming off you know, I think I bought The River, and which was the first Springsteen record that, you know, I bought in real time, and went back and you know, wanted to check out his earlier stuff, and it always kind of stuck out as an oddball item in the Springsteen catalog, because of course this is pre E Street Band, although there were some guys on the record who would later become members in good standing of the E Street Band. But it's kind of a jumble of singer-songwriter type songs like Mary Queen of Arkansas and The Angel, and then more really kind of ones like Blinded by the Light, like you were just playing, that kind of pointed more in the direction he would go with the Wild, the Innocent, the E Street Shuffle. And then, you know, some more kind of, you know, ones that were kind of somewhere in between, things like Growing Up and For You, It's Hard to Be a Saint in the City, and you know, all of which had a little bit of Van Morrison, Bob Dylan influence, but were also clearly, you know, he had clearly found his voice already.
I love the description that you include in the piece. Lester Bangs, the great Rolling Stone critic, talking about Springsteen and described him as sort of like Robbie Robertson on Quaaludes with Dylan barfing down the back of his neck.
Yeah, if you could, pretty much the only person who is more verbose than Springsteen in this period was Lester Bangs. So I think it's kind of beautiful that he wound up reviewing this album. But it was interesting to me going back and looking at that review. That Greetings from Asbury Park came out in January of 1973. That review didn't run in Rolling Stone until almost 6 months later, which I think, you know, a Springsteen record now, of course, would get a review in Rolling Stone, you know, the minute the promos hit the desk. But back then, he clearly was not on on the mainstream music media's radar.
You point out, too, and I thought this was very interesting. This was his first album, but he had been making music for a while before this. And this album was very different because of the lyrical nature than his previous work had been.
Yeah, his band, he'd actually been in a band before this called Steel Mill, which was, there are a few tracks of theirs that are out there legally that you can listen to. And they're kind of hard rock. They're more kind of jam oriented. They're not, I would say if they're probably closer in content and spirit to something like Humble Pie than to anything on Greetings from Asbury Park. And I think what had happened, and Bruce talks about this a bit in his autobiography, Born to Run, was that, you know, he'd been playing in bands for years up to this point and really had not had much success. And Steel Mill was only kind of a regional success in New Jersey, but they, you know, never got a recording deal or anything. And he kind of figured that his best way, really his only option at this point, was to go the singer-songwriter route. And to you know, he had a lot of words in his head that he wanted to get out on paper. And so when he auditioned for CBS Records, it was as this kind of acoustic troubadour with, you know, with a ton of words at his disposal. And they really saw him as kind of this new Dylan figure. And of course, back in the early 70s, everybody was looking for a new Dylan. And but between the time that he was signed to CBS and when he started making the record, it, you know, I think he realized that was not what he wanted to be completely seen as, and he wanted to get other musicians on the record. He didn't want it to be an all, you know, all acoustic and voice type of record.
And he got the deal with Columbia on the strength of the song that ended up being the final track on the album.
Right, It's Hard to Be a Saint in the City, which is probably my favorite song off the record. But when he played it for John Hammond in his office, it was just on an acoustic guitar, and it's really, you know, with more of a full band arrangement on the record, which really kind of gives it a more evocative feel as far as I'm concerned. And then, you know, if you listen to bootlegs, Springsteen bootlegs from the 70s when he was playing with the E Street Band, and Miami Steve was in the band by this point, that song would really get sort of drawn out into like into a long guitar jam with him trading licks. That was quite dramatic and cool. But really like the way it ends, Greetings from Asbury Park.
Now, even though this was his first album, he asserted a little bit of independence in the title of the album because he wanted to distinguish himself as being somebody from New Jersey and not someplace else.
Yeah, his Jersey roots were really important to him. I mean, that really was his life, was, you know, growing up in Freehold in Asbury Park, New Jersey. But when he signed with Columbia, they really wanted to market him as a New York artist. And I think some of that was because in a lot of these songs that made it onto this record, there are references to New York City. There are, you know, images that, you know, make you think of you know, early 70s Big Apple. But, and I think some of it too was that, you know, as part of the New Dylan concept, you know, it would hold more weight if he was from New York as opposed to New Jersey. But he, you know, he insisted that you know, they had to be honest about where he was coming from, you know, literally and figuratively. And you know, if you think back to the early 70s, it was pretty rare for an artist, especially, you know, a solo artist, to not have their photo on the cover of their debut album. So for him to lead with an album that's basically this old-fashioned postcard of Asbury Park, that was actually pretty radical for the time.
We're talking with Dan Epstein here on Downtown. Was it, I'm trying to remember the chronology here, was it before or after the release of Greetings from Asbury Park that John Lando famously said, I've seen the future of rock and roll, and his name is Bruce Springsteen?
Oh, that was after. I think that was about 2 years after, in fact. That was after Wild Innocent A Street Shuffle came out, but before Born to Run.
Interesting, too, the producers of this first album and their connection, not one people would expect, to the Partridge Family.
Yeah, that's Springsteen's first manager, a guy named Mike Appel, was actually, he'd been in the music business since the mid-60s. He had played guitar and written songs for various one-off, you know, kind of one-hit wonders like Magicians, who had a song called Invitation to Cry, and the Balloon Farm, who had a kind of psychedelic hit called The Question of Temperature. But by the time he got around to, you know, when he hooked up with Springsteen, he was best known in the music business for having written songs for the Partridge Family, along with his partner, a guy named Jim Kritikos. And they had, actually, the Partridge Family had one very big hit with a song called Doesn't Anybody Want to Be Wanted that Kritikos and Appel had written. So it's interesting that, you know, Springsteen, who's a person we think of as, you know, an artist of, you know, impeccable credibility, at the time, the Partridge Family, I mean, though they're quite loved today in a kind of nostalgic way, at the time, the Partridge Family were the antithesis of credibility. They were this, you know, manufactured for TV bubblegum group. But here is one of their songwriters managing this hot young singer-songwriter named Bruce Springsteen.
Now, if I remember right, wasn't it Mike Appel that he ended up in a lawsuit with that kept him from recording for a couple of years?
Yeah, the big break between Born to Run and Darkness on the Edge of Town was due to that lawsuit. I think, you know, what had happened was that Springsteen, like most, you know, so many artists who are starting out in the business, signed a management deal with Appel that, you know, grossly favored the manager. But at the time, it was sort of a choice between, do I sign this contract with this guy or do I keep kind of, you know, trying this on my own and butting my head against the wall, whereas here's this guy who can help me out. And I think that's a conundrum a lot of artists still face to this day. And in Springsteen's autobiography, he talks about, you know, really like what a raw deal it was. But at the same time, he has a lot of gratitude and love for Mike Appel, because if it hadn't been for Appel, he wouldn't have got him that audition with John Hammond at Columbia.
You point out in your Rolling Stone piece that two of the best-known songs from the album and two that are still performed a lot in concert, Blinded by the Light and Spirit in the Night, almost didn't even make it in.
Yeah, they were not on the original running order. He actually hadn't even written them by the time that he and Appel handed in the, you know, what they thought was the finished version of Greetings from Asbury Park to Clive Davis at Columbia. And at the time, at that point in the making of the record, it had been split 50-50 into songs with a band and acoustic songs. And what happened was they handed it to Clive, and Clive said, you know, I don't hear a single on this. So he kicked it back to them, and Springsteen, from the sound of it, like in a matter of a week, wrote both Blinded by the Light and Spirit in the Night, and they kicked off three of the acoustic songs that had been recorded to make room for those two songs. And they really, you know, I mean, I think not only are those two of the strongest songs on the record, but they really pointed the direction that he was going in as an artist, more kind of, you know, more R&B influenced, kind of experimental musically. And, you know, you can really draw a direct line from those songs to The Wild, the Innocent, and the E Street Shuffle, which is my personal favorite Springsteen record, which actually came out only about 9 months later.
My Springsteen story is one I'd sort of forgotten about, and I was reminded of it indirectly through you. You had posted a picture of some vinyl. You were listening to a lot of 45s, and I got myself a brand new turntable and went back and got into my old albums, and I found a bunch of Springsteen albums. And the story is back in 85, I was working at a country radio station doing mornings and programming the music, and we started playing I'm on Fire and My Hometown. And we were a reporting station to radio and records and Billboard in those days. Sure. And they ended up doing an article on us playing Springsteen on a country station in Billboard. A few weeks later, I get a box in the mail, and there's a letter in it from John Landau. Saw the story in Billboard and just want to thank you for your support of Bruce's music. Here's a little token of our appreciation. And it was every Springsteen album that had been recorded up to that time, autographed by Bruce.
Wow. Do you still have them?
I do. And I found them the other night when I had to road test that brand new turntable. So thanks to you.
Oh man, I'm glad you've reacquainted yourself with that stash. That sounds pretty amazing.
Absolutely. So here we are 45 years later. Obviously, Springsteen has fulfilled the promise of that first album. But has he ever captured, could he ever capture the feeling that people had when they heard that sound for the first time in 73?
I don't think so. I mean, I think it's really a moment in time that's kind of magically captured by this record. And you know, and I don't know that he could recapture it. I don't know that he'd want to. I think it's very, it's very much honest. It's very much him. It's very much him at, you know, age 23, you know, living in some dumpy apartment, you know, down by the Asbury Park boardwalk, and, you know, living on, you know, his accumulated change. And, you know, it's a remarkable record to me, because it really does kind of perfectly illustrates him right before. I mean, he doesn't really take off with the next record. His build really was actually kind of gradual when you think about it, but he really does kind of take off artistically on the next record. And each record after this would be very different from the one that came before it.
And he survived immediate fame. It wasn't immediate for him, because he'd been going at it for years. But when he ended up on the cover of Time and Newsweek simultaneously, and there was always a blowback to that kind of thing. And he continued to make good music. But to me, he's made some great music and some of his best music when he stopped caring about fame into the 90s and in this century.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, probably my least favorite Springsteen record is Born in the USA. And, you know, some of that has to do with the 80s production values on it. And some of it has to do with just, you know, I heard all those songs a million times in 84 and 85 and really don't need to hear them again. But I feel like that was the one record that he made where he was just really going for it and thinking about, like, taking it, you know, how do we take this to the next level commercially? And I think he, you know, if you read his book, I think he has a lot of regrets about that and where, you know, where that led him. And I think, you know, so many of the records he made after that were a, you know, kind of almost a violent reaction to what that had experience had been like for him.
That is Dan Epstein, a terrific piece in Rolling Stone, the 45th anniversary of the first Bruce Springsteen album. Greetings from Asbury Park, New Jersey. Speaking of music, when we come back, Rock and Roll Hall of Famer has been making music for half a century now. You hear him every single weeknight on our sister station, WKIT, Nights with Alice Cooper. We caught up with Alice at night in Hawaii, of all places. That conversation is next on The Best of Downtown.
When it comes to your health, early detection is the best protection. That's why the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center provides 3D mammography to offer better answers and greater peace of mind, identifying problem areas that a standard mammogram might miss. It provides precise images for all women, including those with dense breast tissue. Call 907-1682 to schedule your 3D mammogram at the St. Joseph Regional Breast Care Center. 3D, providing peace of mind for you, your family, and your loved ones.
Since its founding in 1954, Cross Insurance has grown from a small family-owned agency that started in Bangor, Maine, into one of the largest super-regional insurance agencies in New England. With a network of offices throughout New England, Cross Insurance works with top carriers to provide maximum value to you, your family, and your business. We are proud to be the official insurance broker of the New England Patriots and would welcome the chance to provide security for your team. For more information, visit crossinsurance.com. Cross Insurance, where security meets strength.
At this busy time of year, there's nothing better than a place that offers you one-stop shopping. That place is G&M Family Market on the corner of Route 1A and Route 46 in Holden. Fresh produce delivered daily, a great selection of meats and seafood, beer and wine, of course, a Dunkin' Donuts and an Amato's right on site. Stop into G&M Family Market every day of the week from 6 in the morning till 9 o'clock at night, and if they don't have what you're looking for, they'll make every effort to get it next time. G&M Family Market, Route 1A and Route 46 in Holden.
There's only one way Hartley's Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram in Newport does business. The right way. Owned and operated for over 60 years by the Hartley family, Hartley's offers the same or even better prices and discounts on vehicles as those offered at mega dealerships. And along with that comes their renowned small dealer service and exceptional attitude toward you, their customers. Hartley's values your business and your trust. You're never pushed, never pressured. No one will chase you around the lot, but no one will ignore you either. Hartley's wants you to feel comfortable at their dealership. So feel free to look around, and Hartley's professional sales staff will always be there when you need help. You'll like the place, you'll like the people, and you'll like the way they do business. The right way. The folks at Hartley's wouldn't do it any other way. Always remember, if you're out there looking around, the best deals aren't in the city, they're in the country. Hartley's Country, at the Triangle in Newport. You'll always be treated the right way at Hartley's.
Go Blue!
Sir, you're here for the cheerleading tryouts?
Yeah, for the class of 82. Gotta show my school spirit.
I know a better way. The UMaine Alumni Signature Rewards Visa Card from University Credit Union. Low rates, no annual fees, and it earns reward points for travel, merchandise, or cash back.
Woo, sounds easier than a backflip.
Apply online today at UMaineAlumniCard.com.
Federally insured by NCUA. Terms and conditions apply, subject to credit approval.
It's game time at the Oriental Jade. Score. Two poo-poo platters, a big pork fried rice, and the Jade's new dragon tenders for just $25. Takeout and delivery from the Oriental Jade, Maine's authentic Asian dining experience next to Bangor Mall. How hungry are you? Two poo-poo platters, a big pork fried rice, and the Jade's new dragon tenders for just $25. Takeout and delivery from the Oriental Jade. Begin your experience now at OrientalJade.com.
Hey there, and welcome again to the Muppet Show. Hey, tonight our special guest star is one of the world's most talented but frightening performers, Alice Cooper. So beware of ghoulies and ghosties and long-legged beasties and things that go bump in the night. that does it. I'm leaving. Here's Alice Cooper.
How did I miss that? How did I not know Alice Cooper had done the Muppet Show?
I don't know, because I was fully aware.
Welcome to my nightmare.
Wow. Now I have to go watch that entire episode. Well, that is fantastic. Well, you know, after talking with Alice Cooper, I shouldn't be surprised by anything, because he's such an interesting guy. We caught up with him recently in Maui, where he talked about all kinds of things, the radio show, his latest album, and his upcoming appearance as King Herod in the NBC live broadcast of Jesus Christ Superstar. Here's Alice Cooper on the Best of Downtown.
I'm in Maui right now.
That's not so bad compared to what we've got here in Maine.
I'll bet. Must be like, what, 14 feet deep in snow?
It feels that way, yeah. We had a stretch of about 2 weeks of just absolutely brutal weather, but yeah, it's going to warm up to 40 later this week. So that's, for us, that's like Maui.
That's, you know what? I really feel sorry for you. Could you pass the suntan lotion?
Oh, you're killing me. You're killing me. Well, hey, we're so excited to have your show on our sister station, WKIT. Nights with Alice Cooper is such a fun show. First of all, great music. You have such an encyclopedic knowledge of music. How do you go about picking the songs that you play?
You know, it's one of those things where I understand that there are certain songs that, you know, that are kind of like the 40 or 50 greatest FM songs, you know, that you play. But I don't want for people to forget bands like Paul Butterfield or the Yardbirds or the Hollies or the Who or Them, you know, bands that that don't get in that top echelon. And I grew up with all these bands. So I know it's almost like you could say any band and I'll tell you a great story about them because, you know, we've been on the road for 50 years. So you kind of know everybody. And it's just, you know, it's fun to talk about them. And it's so funny that certain guys and bands, I might be making fun of them, and you would think that they'd be mad at me, and they get mad if I don't make fun of them. They actually get mad if they say, hey, you quit making fun of us. What happened?
Well, that's one of the great things about the show, the stories that you tell, and we've said often here in the station, Alice Cooper has got to know everybody in the history of the music business.
Well, I pretty much, you know, I mean, from the Beatles to the Sex Pistols, you know, I mean, it's sort of like you have a relationship. When you're in a rock band, you are in a fraternity with every rocker there, and you've either met them at award shows or at festivals or, on, you know, at O'Hare Airport or whatever, but you do have a relationship with almost every single band.
The newest album, Paranormal, is in so many ways a classic Alice Cooper sound to it, but he also got some impressive folks together with you, some of the old band members, some great guests, and also reunited with Bob Ezrin.
Bob and I, you know, Bob is sort of my George Martin. He's always been the guy that I've worked with, and even when I'm doing an album that he's not producing, I will call him up and I'll say, I've got five songs here. Let me send them to you, and he'll listen to them and send back notes, you know, saying this bridge isn't strong enough. Why are you going to G here? Well, let's go to another one, you know. And he is sort of my guru when it comes to that. But I've done 13 or 14 albums with him, so you know I plan on working with Bob as much as I possibly can.
So excited for what's coming up on Easter Sunday on NBC, Jesus Christ Superstar live with, my gosh, what a cast, John Legend, Sarah Bareilles, and you as King Herod. How did this whole project come to you?
You know, I actually did the King Herod song on the original soundtrack. Tim Rice is a very good friend of mine, and the guy that did it before, he says, I want to replace that one. He said, will you do the Herod song? And I said, how do you want me to do it? And he says, well, I want Herod to be arrogant, and I want him to be creepy, and I want him to be kind. I said, okay, I can do that. So I did the song on the album, and then when it came up that they were going to do it on stage, you know, Tim said, Alice Cooper, he's got to play Herod. So it's fun. You know, learning the song is something now, I'm all day, you know, half an hour a day I sit and sing the song just to get it down. I don't know what the direction is going to be in it, but it'll be fun to do.
By the way, I absolutely love the documentary that you were such a big part of on your longtime manager, Shep Gordon. He's got to be one of the most interesting people you've come across in the music business.
I'm actually staying at his house right now in Maui, and we've been together 48 years and still have no contract with each other. You know, Shep is the guy, he's the ultimate manager. He's the manager that everybody wants. You know, anytime you can get a manager that you don't need a contract with because you know he's going to be honest with you, that's the guy that everybody's looking for. So we have a very different relationship than anybody else in this business. Nobody has that. 48 years with the same guy.
We're talking with Alice Cooper here on Downtown. I saw an interesting interview with you not too long ago, talking about your friendship with Glenn Campbell. Now, that for some people might seem like an incongruous match, an odd couple of sorts, but you guys had an awful lot in common.
We did. We, you know, honestly, we both lived in Phoenix. Of course, I knew Glenn Campbell of, you know, from a lot of different aspects. We both played golf, and he was a very good player. We were both about equal when it came to, you know, our golf. We were both like 4 handicaps, and we played a lot of golf together. But Glenn was really one of those guys that could do everything. He was just one of those, you know, you put a guitar in his hands, the guy could play anything. He could play anything that my guitar players could play. He could play anything that, you know, you just name it, and he could do it. In fact, I had Eddie Van Halen one time call me up and says, he says, can you get me a guitar lesson with Glenn? That's how well thought of Glenn Campbell was in the business. And, yeah, our wives were great friends. Our kids were friends, you know. I even went to a Seder, a country western Seder in the South.
Well, I'm trying
and
to picture
one
that.
One of us are Jewish, you know, but it was like very, very unique.
We had Bryan Cranston on our show not too long ago, and he was talking about the fact that having stability in his personal life is what's enabled him to be absolutely crazy in his professional life and in roles. And I wonder, you know, as your life has settled down a little bit on the home front and you take good care of yourself, you're in great shape, does the same thing apply to you, that having that stability make it possible for you to go out and do the same things on stage that you were doing 40 years ago?
Oh, absolutely. And Bryan Cranston is one of my favorite people in the world. He is truly insane and one of the greatest actors. I mean, the guy, he's got a very strange sense of humor, though. I don't know if you saw that thing he did on Sweet 60, his birthday party.
I did see that. It was
one of the funniest things I've seen ever. But anyways, yeah, the stability is really the bottom line on everything. When I was, you know, in my 20s, I was hanging out with Jim Morrison and Jimi Hendrix and Keith Moon and those guys. And yeah, the fact of getting to 30 would have been an accomplishment. You know, a lot of those guys didn't. They got to 27 and, you know, just burned out. I met the right girl at the right time. And the Welcome to My Nightmare show, Cheryl, my wife Cheryl, was 18 years old. She was the ballerina in the Welcome to My Nightmare show. And we got married the next year, and we've been married now 41 years. And the stability there is right. I've never cheated on her. She's, you know, our dads were both pastors. We're both Christian. You know, we go to church together and everything like that. Our kids are great. You know, we never had rock star kids that were in trouble. These kids were, like, very respectful, even though insane. Calico, my daughter, is an improv comedian. But never had a problem with drugs or alcohol or getting pregnant or anything like that. You know, never got arrested for anything. But totally insane. My son Dash has got his own band called Co-op, who are really good. These guys are really good. And he's got twin sons, Falcon and Riot, who are my grandsons now, 3 years old. And then my youngest daughter, Sonora, is a makeup artist. And, you know, she can do everything from The Walking Dead to Vogue magazine. So it's the most happy family you've ever seen. You know, we don't have a lot of stress in our relationships at all. And I'm doing what I get to do. I get to write songs, perform songs, and I get to play this character, Alice Cooper, that is really fun to play. And doing the radio show is just, for me, is just like, I don't look at it as work at all. I look at it just as fun to do, you know.
Well, and what's great about that, too, is with technology today, you're able to do that from all over the world. I know when you were on your European tour, you were doing the show from there, now out in Maui. And that's going to make it not just easier, but fun and give you more stories to tell along the way.
Well yeah. And also, I mean, I give the credit. I'm not a big technology guy. You know, I'm more analog than anything else. But at the same time, it allows me, if you have Pro Tools, you can do the radio show from an airport. You can do it from a tour bus. You can do it from anywhere. And my show goes out to almost 200 stations around the world. I mean, we're on in Budapest. We're on in, you know, the strangest places in the world, you know. And yeah, I tape the show, and it takes, you know, I tape it 10 days in advance. And that way everybody gets covered. But, I mean, to me, again, I've been on 14 years now, and I never get bored doing the radio show.
You're a guy that so many people look up to now. You're a role model for a lot of people in the music business. And you hear people, critics sometimes and others, who say, oh, rock is dead. What's your view on the status of rock music today, some 60 years or so into this genre?
You know, I don't think rock will ever be dead. I really don't. I think there's kids right now in a garage learning AC/DC and Guns N' Roses and Alice Cooper and Aerosmith. And I don't think rock will ever die because it's just too primal and it's too much fun. I think you're going to see, I'm going to do a prediction right now, you're going to see a resurgence of the 80s hair bands, you know, because that era was too much fun. The Bon Jovis, the Guns N' Roses, the, you know, those, all those bands. You'll see, and it's going to be a, what I would call a revolution and a total rebellion against high tech. Right now, vinyl is selling more than it's ever sold. Every year, vinyl goes up like 71% or something like that.
Yeah.
That means that kids are now tired of buying air. They're tired of streaming. They want to actually open an album, put it on a turntable, and put the needle down and listen to it and look at who wrote what and who played what. And I think as far as the state of it, as long as there's the Foo Fighters, as long as there's bands like Green Day, as long as there's bands like Black Keys, you know, there's a band in Ireland called The Stripes that I love, and The Strokes are great, and, you know, The Struts, another good band. Alice Cooper, Aerosmith, we're always going to play hard rock. I mean, that's just the way it is. I think hard rock's going to be pretty healthy.
What keeps it fun and keeps it fresh for you?
I never grew up out of it. I never, ever got tired of rock and roll. I never got tired of being Alice. I never got tired of getting on stage and doing a show and seeing the audience react to it. You know, I think you can't get tired of it. After 50 years, I get on stage now with probably the best touring band I've ever had and just rock the place. I think the people are now shocked more by the energy than they are than the theatrics, you know. And I realize that people come now to hear the music. They come to hear those songs, all those hits, and at the same time they get the theatrics with it, and they get Alice, and they get the show. So what I've noticed is around the world is the first 50 rows are 15 to 25 years old. And they know every lyric, you know. I mean, that's great to get out there on the road and see, you know, 15,000 people there that know all the songs.
Well, Alice, we love the radio show. The new album is phenomenal. So great to have you still out there making music, and we really appreciate you making time for us here on the program.
Oh, thanks a lot. And, you know, my buddy Stephen King is there, you know, so he's still writing the best stuff. You see It?
Yeah, I mean, talk about another guy who's at the top of his game after all these years, much like you.
Oh, my gosh. His, you know, his books, though, are like 5 inches thick. You know, if you're going to pick up a Stephen King book, you've got to, you know, decide, well, I've got 4 months in jail, so I might as well just read this. I thought Salem's Lot was the best movie that ever got made from his books.
Scariest. I was in high school. I read that book, and I'm in my room, couldn't put it down, couldn't shut out the lights because I was so scared. And I hit that moment where Danny Glick shows up in the window, and I let out a scream. And my mom came in and said, "What the hell's going on?"
How about the scene where the guy's in the jail, and the first time you see Barlow?
Oh,
the whole screen is Barlow,
yeah.
And literally took my breath. I went, I mean, it was the scariest vampire I'd ever seen in my life.
Oh, that's awesome. Alice, thank you so much. Great to talk with you.
Hey, thanks a lot, and thanks for having me on the show, guys.
That is the legendary Alice Cooper right here in the Best of Downtown as we get set to wrap it up on your Sunday morning. Thanks to Alice, the great Leslie Visser, and the equally great Dan Epstein. for joining us. We're live tomorrow. Hope you'll be around tomorrow afternoon, 4 o'clock on the program. Mike Lowe, the Portland Press Herald, talks Patriots with us. Alan Adams of the Main Edge, movie reviews on Pass the Popcorn. We'll have a healthy, active living minute from our friends at St. Joe's Healthcare and a few other surprises lined up for tomorrow. Enjoy the rest of your weekend. Carrie, behave yourself today.
I'm going to be watching the Muppets all day now.
You've inspired me now. I think I have to do that. That is fabulous. Good stuff right there. We'll see you tomorrow afternoon. Have a good Sunday. We'll catch you at 4 right here tomorrow on Downtown. You're going to be all right.